I want to start first by talking about why research libraries are important to me as a researcher, and to end with a sense of why the Schomburg is such an important place for doing research. As a graduate student at Rutgers University, I had the pleasure of not just finishing a PhD under a very esteemed scholar, David Levering Lewis, as an intellectual historian and a biographer of some of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, and someone whose span of work could move from civil rights leaders to understanding colonialism, to understanding the spread of Islam in Europe in the 13th century, all of which has an impact on a graduate student in terms of their curiosity and reach. But it actually, in this conversation, was an unexpected encounter with research that I think is more telling about why libraries are so important. I think the subtext of our gathering here today is partly about the relationship between the humanities today and the STEM fields. And I say that partly because it's not really on the table, but as someone who spent 6 years at a university as a professor and was part of conversations about building new buildings and investing in the future of that university, it was about the sciences. It was about engineering. And time again, my colleagues in the humanities bemoaned their shrinking budgets and potentially shrinking fortunes in terms of the future at the university. So it is that context that led me to reflect upon a research assignment I had working with someone who was doing work on the history of the sciences, which led me to a biomedical research library, which, as you can imagine, is not a place that encourages necessarily archival deep thinking, but it's really about patents, it's about finding research equations that have been previously published for scientific researchers. But Keith Wailu was working on two books, one a history of cancer and one a history of pain. And it really opened my mind up to how valuable research is in libraries that are not understood to be places of humanistic inquiry. Those libraries weren't designed for historical work. They weren't designed for asking the questions necessarily, how did we get here, who are we? They were designed to further advance scientific research. But Keith, as is true of many historians of the sciences and technologies, were asking humanistic questions about what do the sciences and technologies mean to who we are as a people? What is the means of the question of what is the means of science is different from what is the end. What is science and technology in the service of something? This question that David has raised about equality. So I learned, just as in celebrating our nerdiness out of doing that research, that the history of cancer had a very deep politicized history about the interpretation of cancer, tied to notions of civilization, that cancer was in fact a consequence of people being less vigorous in society, sitting more. This was part of the physical culture that Teddy Roosevelt was so actively engaged in the early 20th century. That cancer was a part of us not being a physical people any longer, but also tied to questions of race. And evidence of prostate cancer early on among African Americans was tied directly to notions of licentiousness and lascivious behavior. In other words, that in the march of the field of medicine and science, what were taken for granted assumptions about why people contracted disease, of course, shaped the outcomes, the medical outcomes and health outcomes of groups, rooted in very large contextual questions about the society that we lived in, the received wisdom of those human beings. Questions that medical students aren't forced to wrestle with as they're being professionalized. Questions that lab researchers are not forced to wrestle with. They are simply handed a set of protocols that tell them this is how you respond to this, and yet they are of the world, and yet they are shaped and molded by ideology and thoughts. And that's what the history of science and technology provide us, and it's through those libraries that we are able to give caution to our ever forward-moving embrace of science and technology. Another example of technology, a book written by Ruth Cowan called More Work for Mother, was a book rooted in the history of technology. And again, these, for students particularly, like was true for me when as a graduate student I read this book, really transformed the taken for granted usefulness, the tools of technology. And in this case, the book was really about the counterintuitive fact that as labor-saving devices became more available, washing machines, refrigerators, things of that nature, actually, one would think made it easier for an early 20th century, a mid-20th century woman to manage a household. But in fact, just the opposite occurred. There was more work because the assumption was now that you could wear more clothing in a day, that you could have more dishes in a day, or that the division of labor would shift from many people participating in that. So those kind of ways in which the humanities intersect with the sciences and technologies, I think, are taken for granted on the STEM side of the equation. And it's through the work of historians and librarians that we get to understand something about the fact that science and technology is not an end in itself. Libraries are repositories for human creativity and knowledge production, as has been said repeatedly here. And therefore, we cannot learn from our collective successes and failures or appreciate the unintended consequences of innovation, as is true in technology, without actually having a history. And that's what's so powerful about your discussion of maps and cartography, that in fact, it shows us how decisions that we made actually have a context and ultimately a consequence, that we walk on paths that that themselves were crafted out of decisions that may not have been for the better good or the long-term sustenance of our society. In a world shaped by instant communication today, research libraries are more important than ever. Knowledge is a commodity, I would argue, in our contemporary media culture. There is less and less value placed on archival research, which means that it's not simply that we can digitize things. It's not simply that we have blogging and this universe of images that we can snatch from wherever they are. But it is, in fact, the case that it is libraries that lead the way in actually making digital reproductions of primary documents available. Because where those primary documents have no inherent value, it is up to libraries to do it for the betterment of society and humanity that those documents be digitized and made available. And I think that's an incredibly important point because social media, in my opinion, in and of itself, is ahistorical. It is, let me change that, is anti-historical. And by that I mean that it is driven by a constant desire to trend towards the new, to the immediate, to the present. It does not reward those who actually are consumers of it, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, the past. The constant drive is to anticipate and to seek the future. So it will be libraries that wrestle with the dilemmas of presentism in our media culture and in our intellectual culture by joining, in a sense, the back end of social media to the front end of social media to actually do the work of archiving on a digital platform. Because one day, all of those bloggers and social media people will look up and they will say, what have I done for the past 15 years? What did I say 20 years ago? How can I find that evidence, that work? Libraries are the lifeblood of communities. They enrich the lives of people by giving them a reason to care about something deeper, richer, older, and more meaningful than just themselves. Whereas most, as we've discussed here, cannot become collectors, all can be inspired by access and cherish collections. And that is, in fact, what we've heard so much about here today, about the difference that it has made in so many lives because of collections. People need their libraries. Schomburg is a life-saving institution for people who walk through the doors of the Schomburg Research Center every single day because for some of them, the difference between having access to material and not having access to material is having meaning and purpose in the world. Libraries also provide the evidence for counter-narrative, for dissent. If we appreciate and fundamentally cherish that democracy means the right to object, to express dissent, to challenge authority, to change the status quo, you must have libraries that are open to the universe of ideas that are not either celebrated, made legitimate, or even legal in our media discourse. It is libraries that give us the store of human creativity and ideas that may once have been subject to a Sedition Act in the 1790s. So we get to learn how to continue to express ourselves through the language of dissent and counter-narrative by marching in the footsteps of those who have challenged authority in the past. Young people especially benefit from what libraries provide because, in fact, they provide a cultural landscape that is an extension of what the schoolhouse is at the beginning of their day or life and what home is or is not at the end. It is the library that is the midway point, the extension of the possibility of those cultural landscapes and the learning that must take place in order for them to be civically engaged. Finally, let me say a few words about historical literacy. No other institution in our society promotes historical literacy more than the library. And historical literacy is, as Lewis Lapham recently noted in Harper's cover story, ignorance of things past, who wins and who loses when we forget American history, is crucial to shaping the world we live in and the world that we imagine it could be. History is, of course, all around us and has animated any number of political decisions that will shape and or limit the outcomes for young people in this very moment. We must encourage those young people to own history, to appreciate it, to write it, to shape it, to argue it, and to debate it. Otherwise, they will leave it to others to define the past. And as George Orwell once wrote, who controls the past controls the future, who controls the present controls the past. Let me end on this note. The congressman, the senior African-American Charlie Rangel, representing a very long and illustrious career in Congress and advocate for the Schomburg Center in particular, sat with Tony Marks and me about a year ago, looked us both dead in the eye, and said, "The Schomburg Center is all we've got. You've got to make sure that you defend that institution, that it continues to grow and prosper, because it is all that we've got." I would submit to you that if the Schomburg Center goes, in the language of Charlie Rangel, so goes the humanities. Because there, at the bottom of the well, there at a research center that is an anchor to everything that represents the best traditions of counter-narrative and dissent, if you lose that, you lose your ability to change the world, you lose your ability to speak truth to power, and to challenge the status quo, and to remember that those problems and challenges are not new, and that, as has been said here today, you are not alone.